very important questions. In a sense, my work is an interrogation of this great work of Blake's. Now, let me tell you a little bit about the work, and I'll come back to this image in a moment. Actually, I'll show you what it actually turns out to be the title of the book. Well, I'll put it on another slide. The work is called For the Senses, The Gates of Paradise. And you can see from the little notation there, Blake compiled this work over a very long period of time, from 1793 to 1818. It's a pretty long, long time. Portion of his adult life. In fact, when Blake first conceived of this project, he called it For Children, The Gates of Paradise. And it was only in 1818, when he finally caused these works to be published, that he changed it to For the Sexes, The Gates of Paradise. And it gives you an idea, when you hear that, a little bit about Blake, the idea that something for children could also be for the sexes. Not something that would naturally spring to a lot of people, but to Blake, it was a continuity. I mean, this is, after all, a man who would sit naked in the backyard with his wife, and this is a man for whom God looked in his second story window. He also conversed daily with his departed brother who had died years ago, the brother who gave him a good deal of advice about his poetry. So we are in the presence of a person of unusual sensibility, to say the least. So for Blake, it was called originally For Children, The Gates of Paradise, and eventually became For the Sexes, The Gates of Paradise. It is not as famous as probably the great sets that you know. You know the songs of innocence and experience from it. Little Lamb Who Made Thee, Dost Thou Know Who Made Thee, and from the other side, the more experienced side, The Tiger Burning Bright, Blake's wonderful antinomies of innocence, and harmlessness and gentility in the lamb, and the fierceness of the tiger whose energies and complexities are to be admired. For Blake, there really is no, these contradictions are not contradictions for Blake, but he presents them to us to wrestle with. So these things are coming together. Let me give you a little bit more of this. It's a rather short thing. Unlike the Songs of Innocence and Experience, it has a complex structural quality, which, I see someone in the booth. Should I put on my microphone? Okay, this may be a great moment, folks.
Is this, okay, the mic is on, and you can hear me. Is it better or more irritated? It's too loud. Can you come down a little with the mic, please? Less level? Less? Little more? Little more? That's about it, right? You can all hear me?
Yes.
And now I'm being recorded for whatever posterity there shall be. Okay, so as I was saying, this work has a very interesting structure. It begins with a poem which I will read to you. It's then followed by a series of drawings which represent the elements. And then it goes through the life cycle of a person with a series of emblematic drawings which are instructional drawings. And it concludes with another poem. And when we get to the final poem, I'm going to ask Lisa Moore to come up, and I'll give you an example of how this fits together as a piece of music. So I'm kind of saving the best for last, so if you'll be patient, it's kind of keeping the audience captured in their seats for a moment. I will take one step back before that to tell you that I have just completed a cycle of works which I call Opere della Musica Povera, Works of a Poor Music. 12 works I've been working on for the last 9 years, which take as their sources literary, historical, and other elements. And Blake seemed to fit perfectly. So I took one of the things from this cycle of event, this Gates of Paradise, and I made a work out of it. But as soon as I did that, I knew that the work had much greater implications. Again, Bresnik after Blake. I engaged with the material. I saw the material was much more pregnant, much richer than I had first imagined, and I began to have other ideas about how to interact with this Blake material. Let me show you the Blake material first. I think you will enjoy it, and you may see why it was so attractive to me. So Blake begins with this image, and it's an interesting image indeed. I won't dwell too much on this. I must say I've had a great deal of fun. I teach at Yale, as you know, although I haven't been there for the last couple of years, but I have had a great deal of fun talking to Harold Bloom about this at Yale, who is quite a remarkable literary critic and sort of wild man genius who walks into trees and generally has to be stopped before he falls over occasionally. But he is a remarkable genius, actually, and he has talked to me about this, and I intend to have some more conversation with him about this material. So anything that I say that has any intelligence about it, I ascribe to my conversations with him. The stupid parts are probably my own. You see here the opening image, and underneath the image is a little saying, "What is man? The sun's light, when he unfolds it, depends upon the organ, depends on the organ that beholds it." And that's how Blake begins. But you will see that this image of this little baby in the form of a kind of grub, really, on a leaf with a caterpillar. Can you all see the caterpillar on the leaf? Is actually an image that is going to play an important part later in the cycle. So right away, it's a little disorderly, and part of my task has been, in working with this, to order it. Blake begins with a prologue as follows. "Mutual forgiveness of each vice, such are the gates of paradise. Against the accuser's chief desire, who walked among the stones of fire, Jehovah's finger wrote the law, then wept. Then rose in zeal and awe, and the dead corpse from Sinai's heat buried beneath his mercy seat. O Christians, Christians, tell me why you rear it on your altars high." Now, we've just heard a poem of 10 lines, words we all know, images we are all familiar with, and yet it's not easy, is it, to figure out what that's about? And it's part of the power of Blake and the mystery of Blake that with these simple, earnest words, he casts our thoughts into a complex space in which we really have to wrestle to understand them. Some of them are so personal that Blake is just idiosyncratic and cannot be followed. Those of you who are interested in the history of religion may find E.P. Thompson's book about Blake very interesting, in which he discovered that Blake was one of the last of the Muggletonians. Anybody here ever hear of the Muggletonians? It was a dissenting Protestant sect founded around the time of Cromwell, similar to Shakers and Quakers and Ranters and Diggers, part of that same group of people. And Blake was one of the last of a group of those types who finally felt that there really was no sin, that a truly loving God would make no sin. That's a complex idea, no sin. And he asks in this poem why Christians should rear the tablets of Moses on their altars, because the tablets of Moses are full of thou shalt nots. And for Blake, thou shalt not is not godly. And this is a problem. This is a radical poet, hard to understand, interesting poet. And then he follows with the question, what is man? And he asks the question, he goes on, "The caterpillar on the leaf reminds thee of thy mother's grief. The sense of birth and mortality locked together." Now I'm going to move through these a little more quickly, and then I'll tell you why I'm doing this and what I'm doing with it. I'm going to give it to you in the order that I'm going to use it, and not the order that that Blake has, because I think you'll actually get the point more easily if I do. Okay. So begins now a cycle of the elements. Water. Thou waterest him with tears. I'll take you through these all, then I'll read the little poem that's associated with it. By the way, these images in Blake's engraving are tiny. They're not more than about that big. They're very small. Earth. He struggles into life. I think art teachers probably are better at this than me, but I'll do my best. Air. On cloudy doubts and reasoning cares. Fire, that end in endless strife. Okay, so Blake has now given you earth, water, fire, and air. He's given you four basic elements, and he's given you a kind of a commentary about it, a complex commentary about it. And in a further section in his poem, he has now a little series of commentaries about the images. He writes, doubt, self-jealous, watery folly, and we see that image of water, struggling through earth's melancholy, we see that character emerging through the earth, naked in air, in shame and fear, that character crouching with the stars, remember that one? And finally, fire, that end in endless strife, blind in fire with shield and spear. So we've now established the four elements that Blake is going to work with, and we've seen the complexity of those elements, how they live in a human's life. You'll see in a moment when we get to some of these images, I think will actually strike you as very familiar. And I think, how many of you have actually seen these images before? Any of you? Not many, probably, but that's nice that you have. You can see how wonderful they are, but how little known they actually are. I love this one. I found him beneath a tree. And here Blake shows a woman pulling babies sort of out of the ground as if they were, he turns out that he calls them mandrakes. He thinks of them as a kind of mandrake, a kind of plant-animal combination. Remember that early image we saw of the caterpillar on the leaf and the little baby? We are already in a vegetal image of growth and birth. I'll just show you a few more of these, and then I'll read some more of the poems that are associated with them. Just to tell you so you're not worried, there's only 16 of these. This won't go on for hours and hours. At length, ripe for hatching ripe, he breaks the shell. And the little baby emerges from the egg, a real egg there, actually, in the middle of the sky. It seems that Blake actually intended, as an aside here, Blake intended these to be kind of instructional books about the life cycle of a person. And he goes on in his poem as follows.
My eternal man set in repose, the female from his darkness rose, and she found me beneath a tree, a mandrake, and in her veil hid me. Okay, so we have this concept of this little finding this baby, this woman finds, the woman arrives from the man in the darkness, and then finds a baby, and hides the baby. I'm going to take you quickly through the rest because I want to get you to the music. Blake goes on. Serpent reasonings us entice of good and evil, virtue and vice. Two-horned reasoning, cloven fiction, in doubt, which is self-contradiction, a dark hermaphrodite we stood, rational truth, root of evil and good. Round me flew the flaming sword, round her snowy whirlwinds roared, freezing her veil, the mundane shell. I rent the veil where the dead dwell. When weary man enters his cave, he meets his savior in the grave. Some find a female garment there, and some a male, woven with care, lest the sexual garments sweet should grow a devouring winding sheet. I'll come back to that. That's already, it's intense, Blake, isn't it? I mean, it's like, wow, okay. So we go to the grave, and in the grave we are reborn in the grave, and we are born, we are a dark hermaphrodite in the grave, Blake says. And some are given the female garment, and some are given the male garment. And these sexual garments sweet should be sweet, lest they become, he says, a devouring winding sheet. A winding sheet is, of course, a sheet for a funeral situation. Blake has given us now a story of the elements, and now a story of a pre-story of life. And then he begins again. And we have our image. Remember the baby hatching from the egg. He says, in vain glory, hatched and nursed, by double specters self-accursed. So the baby is born in vainglory. That baby is not necessarily such a good baby. Again, one of the more remarkable images. What are these, alas, the female martyr? Is she also the divine image? Is she the female martyr made in the shape of God? Asks Blake. And what you see is a picture of the young dandy, the young boy grown up from the egg. Now he's very kind of carelessly walking by, and look, two fallen, one figure flying away, and one figure lies prone on the ground, a female figure. And Blake says, one dies, alas, the living and dead. One is slain, and one is fled. Okay, so the young boy has now had his kind of romantic moment, and then he becomes a prodigal. And we have this kind of the image of the prodigal son, but what is the prodigal son carrying? A spear aimed at the heart of his father. And the father sits in despair upon his seat and says, my son, and Blake says, my son, thou treatest me but as I have instructed thee. No, not to blame the son in this case. And so the son now has gone from his romantic stage now to his challenging, kind of adolescent challenge to his father, and then he does what we all do, right? He stands with his beloved partner, and they gaze up at the moon. I want, he says. Climbing through the shadows of the moon, climbing through night's highest noon. this need for something that we really can't have. Can we climb to the moon? On a ladder, anyway? Probably not. And then, and you can see a figure drowning in the water and crying, "Help, help." And Blake says of the figure, in time's ocean, falling, drowned. So the figure is not drowning merely in a literal ocean, but the figure is drowning in an ocean of time. The time is eternity, of course. And that now, our young man has grown a bit older. And typically for Blake, age is not necessarily wisdom. There he says, aged ignorance, perceptive organs closed, their objects closed. As they age, they no longer even see what to look at. And look what the aged is doing to the young newborn. Blake says, in aged ignorance profound, holy and cold, I clip the wings of all sublunary things, that is, things below the moon. And then Blake is horrified at such hostility to children, to the young, such clipping, such restraints we place on our young. And he thinks about organized religion, which was for him, most religions were difficult, not good. And he asks the question, does thy God, O priest, take such vengeance as this? And you see the father and the sons in a dungeon. And Blake says, he goes on to say, and in the depths of my dungeons closed the father and the sons. Things started off kind of troublesome, and they haven't gotten a lot better, one would have to say. But there is hope for Blake. The mystic sees that fear and hope at the side of the dying parent are vision, and the children loyally by the bedside of the departed see a vision of the emerging spirit of the dead parent. And finally, Blake meditates on that door. Well, actually, I'm going to take you now to what he really does. I wanted to come back to it. And now we see where my initial drawing comes in. Remember that we had the evaporating spirit, and now we have the traveler. The traveler hasteth in the evening, says Blake. And of the traveler, he says, through evening shades I haste away to close the labors of my day. I'll come back to that one. It's kind of an important one. And we finally arrive at the destination that we all face. And notice Blake's image of death's door, the aged man before it. And in a sense, the wind blows behind him to help him across the threshold. Notice that in a sense, he's being eased to that place, and he stands before death's door, and Blake says, the door of death I opened, found, and the worm weaving in the ground. And he comes finally to this adaptation of a passage from Job. The last of the images I'll show you tonight. I have said to the worm, thou art my mother and my sister. See the worm around the shrouded figure? And Blake says of the worm, wife, sister, daughter to the tomb, weaving to dreams the sexual strife and weeping over the web of life. And that ends the general outline of the poem and the emblems, with the exception of a final epilogue about which I will tell you in a moment. This struck me as so powerful, and I thought, now what to do about this? One could set it as a poem, make a song cycle, and have all these things sung by somebody. But it seemed to me that doing that would lose a powerful part of what makes this so interesting, is these Blake images. Wouldn't you agree that to lose them, we'd really, I mean, the poem is wonderful, but the images. And of course, you know, if you know Blake, you know that he drew the pictures in the book with the poetry. And Blake's whole aesthetic ideal was a kind of mixed media event. He didn't conceive of his poetry without the illuminations of the pictures. So to cut asunder the union between the picture and the poem would be to reduce Blake's image. Blake didn't think that the picture, even when it replicated the aspects of the text, it did not reduce it for Blake. It enhanced it for Blake. And in many of these images, it's hard to know which came first, right? Whether Blake was richly inspired by the image or richly inspired by the poem. And it seemed to me, if I were to do something with this, and I so wanted to do it, I can't lose these pictures. So I thought, well, how can we do this? We could have a slideshow sort of like this, where some bumbling professor puts things on an overhead projector, and that doesn't seem very, you know, early 21st century. If you've seen anything on MTV, if you watch your television, you notice that every pop song and rock song now is accompanied by a video. In fact, for young people, the idea of rock music without the visual element is almost inconceivable. They don't think of it anymore in any other way. For the last 20 years or so, TV has shown this over and over again. And I thought, what about MTV on an entirely new level? How about an MTV with Blake as the cinematographer? Now that would be something. And so I am in touch with a computer artist named Leslie Weinberg, who is now working with me to put together these images on a computer. She's already done some of them. In the computer, they can be run on a DVD machine. People know what that is? That's a sort of a, like when you rent movies from the store, they come on VHS equipment typically. We all have sort of video players in our homes now. Many of us do. But now they have computer discs that you can bring into your home. She's put them on a computer and computer disc so that these images, when that character emerges from the earth, he literally emerges from the earth. When the traveler hasteth in the evening, he moves. And I can show all these images while having live music go at the same time. The effect, I hope, will be amazing. I mean, I hope it will be amazing. It's not quite movie music, since there is no movie in that sense. And the screen will occasionally grow dark. And the music will drive a lot of the motion of this art object, which I am calling For the Sexes, The Gates of Paradise. I'm not afraid to take advantage of the fact that the title has the word sex in it. Even though, as you see, this is not going to get any kind of rating other than PG, I would say, actually. And so I took this and I have put it together, and I had already finished a piece with a special part. And I'm going to take the opportunity now, if it's okay with Lisa Moore, to have her do the part of the work which comes at the conclusion that I have already written, which will be joined to the new material I will bring to it. I can't give you the full experience yet because it doesn't exist, but I will put the traveler up for you because it's about the traveler. In fact, it's a song called, it's a kind of an event, really, not a song, but it's a kind of piece of music called The Dream of the Lost Traveler. And it actually comes from Blake's final epilogue poem. But before I tell you what that is, I want you to think about the traveler. I want you to hold that traveler in your mind for a moment. I'll put him back up again because I find it such a stirring image. It's what brought me to this project in the first place. When I first saw the project, by the way, it's actually, of course, it's an actual rectangle. It's just the overhead that makes it go, gives it that kind of weird trapezoidal kind of thing. I wondered to myself, it made me think of Henry David Thoreau's little section in Walden where he asked the question, why aren't we in such haste for such desperate enterprises? He's asking, why are we running around like crazy when we could be sort of living by the shores of Walden Pond and thinking about bean rows and heavenly triangles? Interesting question. And I wondered about it in relationship to this character. Why does he hurry in the evening? Where is he going? Why is he in such a hurry? I thought, well, perhaps he's simply in a hurry because he wants to be home before dark, in the words of Cheever's great story. He wants to get home before dark. After all, in the early 19th century, there were not many lights, and it was scary to travel late at night. But of course, for Blake, the idea of traveling in the dark and that whole issue couldn't not have been a serious question. I mean, for him, this had huge mythic ramifications. For Blake, after all, the concept of the immortal soul that cannot die, perhaps the traveler is hurrying because he knows that's a good place to go, to death, that is, because at that point, he becomes part of the eternal, immortal world of the soul. I looked at that traveler a long time and tried to figure out why is he hurrying and where is he hurrying to? And it stayed with me. And the final poem is a poem that retakes us back to the prologue. You remember the accuser's finger wrote the law? No, he talks about the accuser. The accuser for Blake is actually not the devil that a lot of Christian theology has now, that the world is divided between devils and angels. The accuser for Blake is actually Satan, the fallen angel, the Miltonian fallen angel, the great hero, the right hand of God, after Jesus, the highest possible figure, who erred and made an error, but is still an angel. And so Blake writes chidingly in his epilogue, under the title, To the Accuser, Who is the God of This World. Truly, my Satan, thou art but a dunce, and dost not know the garment from the man. Every harlot was a virgin once, nor canst thou ever change Kate into Nan. Though thou art worshipped by the names divine of Jesus and Jehovah, thou art still the son of morn in weary night's decline, the lost traveler's dream under the hill. So let's welcome Lisa Moore, who will play, and you can look at that picture while she plays, The Dream of the Lost Traveler.
Thank you.
See, Bresnik has to follow Blake, then he has to follow Moore. He's always sort of taking up the rear. But so what I've done in that work, you can hear, is a very rich kind of elaboration of the ideas of the final epilogue. Well, I hope rich ideas, rich elaboration of the ideas of the final epilogue. The work that I'm after in my Bresnik After Blake is a work for solo piano, which Lisa Moore will perform in New York on the 20th of March, and hopefully take around with her, as a solo work for piano and computer imagery after these wonderful emblems of William Blake, as a self-contained thing. I don't claim that this is the first time in the history of music such a thing has been done, but I do think it's an interesting new version of a kind of older thing which reunites complex, abstract music with vivid visual imagery and presents a brilliant musician in all the things that she can do. She will read the text, she will sing, she will speak, and these images will go by. I hope you've enjoyed my presentation. Yes, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about any aspect of this event, and don't be shy. Yes?
You know what I missed? That first theme that you had, that searching, strong theme, I hoped it would come up later. That's just, we should have our responses. I'm not being unkind, but I just love
it. I'll ask my wife to do something for us tonight. If she will play the opening of the work and then the end of the work and see what you think.
You did there. I didn't.
See what you think.
Okay.
It's an interesting test. She'll play the very opening and then she'll play the last 8 bars. Play the last 8 bars of the work. I think you see what I'm after here. It doesn't come back the same way, which would be kind of, composers, we don't like to do things the same way. We like to do things a little differently the second time. As Ives, my great kind of imaginary mentor, once said, nature doesn't repeat herself, why the hell should we? But you hear a similar quality, right? Yeah. Well, this is hard. I completely and fervently believe that there's much important stuff being done now in new music, and we're not used to listening to it anymore and kind of thinking our way through it all the way to the end in that way. But, Carlos Williams said very beautifully about poetry. He said, it's really difficult to get the news from poems, but men die miserably every day from lack of what is found there. And you need to get the news from new music.
Other question? Yes?
Speaking of eternal return and other writers on that topic, and the most obvious thing about the beginning and ending music, did you have Zarathustra on your mind?
You know, it's so interesting because, yes, I'll repeat the question. The question had to do with beginnings and endings. And the questioner asked, did I have Zarathustra on my mind, which of course is the great Strauss tone poem. Let's see if I can get this over here, you know. Everybody recognizes that, right? Or not the way I play it, but you probably recognize the idea anyway. You know, somebody said to me, oh, immediately after hearing it said, oh, this is just Mahler. It's just that same major minor thing. The person I had actually in my mind when I wrote this, Schubert, the Winterreise, because of that walking motive. A night journey. And of course, in the Winterreise of Schubert, if you know that work, it begins in the minor and then it has a kind of flashback in the major. But Schubert is also the great master of major and minor alterations. And what the gentleman is referring to in this music is the difference between this sound and this sound. Right? The major sound and the minor sound. And of course, this music keeps going. But then somebody else said, oh, cool, well, that's really not what you're thinking of. You're thinking about the Hammerklavier, right? I steal everything. I have maintained to my students that it is not an original note in any of my music. But no, I actually wasn't thinking of Strauss so much. I was thinking much more of Schubert, actually. Another question. Yes.
Don't you feel a bit of pressure if you're going to produce this in New York on the 28th of March?
I'm sorry you asked that question. It's hard enough to write the piece that's become neurotic about having to finish it. No, you're absolutely right, and of course Lisa has already been killing me about, she has to learn to play it. It's one thing to write it, but she knows she has to play the damn thing. So, yes, I'm feeling terrible pressure, and I'm taking off the mic and I'll see you later. It is very difficult. But I'm used to writing to deadlines, and I do that. That's part of my job. It's not a happy part of my job, I'll grant you, but it's part of my job. Other questions? Yes?
Where in New York in March is it going to be performed?
The question is, where in New York is this going to be performed? It will be performed at Miller Theater, which is at Columbia University, on the 20th, and I hope to see you all there. I will be taking attendance. Yes, that's where we'll be performing. We also will be performing it in Berlin in probably in May, and then we hope to take it to Brisbane, Australia, Lisa's home, to be performing at a festival in Brisbane, and we hope then to take it to Vancouver sometime next year. I'm waiting for the... it's good to write your local representative. Other questions, please. Yes.
I was wondering, couldn't the evening symbolize, in Blake's view, the evening of one's life, or, you know, towards the end, so do everything you can now because you won't have any time?
I think that's right. I think that's surely one of the meanings, absolutely. You know, it's not eternal, our night and day, but as far as human time is concerned, night and day takes on these great symbolic meanings for us. The morning of the youth of life and the evening of the sunset of life is surely part of this cycle, as far as Blake is concerned. Blake speaks to me very powerfully because he said in one of his great little proverbs of hell, he says, mine is not to reason and compare. My business is to create. And that was a warning to all academics, that of which he was not one. Mm-hmm.
And the implication there is, and when you read Blake, you are thrust into this maelstrom of language and imagery, some of it very simple, and some of it extremely complicated. And it's not explained. But you get the feeling, even though it's not explained, Blake wants you to know. He's like a man who's buttonholed you outside in the lobby and taken you by the lapels and said, "Now listen to me, you know, think about this. Now did these feet in ancient time upon England's..." You all know that one, right? That's Blake too. And he's asking, "And were these builded here among these dark satanic mills?" I mean, he's shaking you by the lapels, and yet he won't explain. He doesn't completely explain. And I think that's art's function, is to ask the big question, help you, point you in the right direction without giving you the answer. But I think that's certainly a plausible response. Other question? Yeah.
Can you put into words briefly some of the imagery that you're going to have as the computer?
This, everything you saw, all the images that you saw are being fed into the computer. The man will emerge from beneath the earth. This traveler will walk. This woman will sit with the worm curled around her leg, and the worm may move. I mean, we don't know exactly all the things that will happen. I've tried to make a storyboard for all of it, but I want to leave some room for Leslie to decide. But I'm not going to use any imagery that is not already Blake's. And that's part of the kind of the austerity, the logic of the project. So the images will all come from Blake, and they'll be the images you saw tonight. They're beautiful, and they're worthy of a second look, I think. Question in the back.
We look back in fascination and reverence to Blake. How was he viewed by his contemporaries?
Well, I think, in a word, I think you could say they thought he was crazy. he was an impossible person. He was the kind of person who, even when you befriended him, he was sort of paranoid and he would take offense at everything that you did and said. At the same time, he was one of the most loving, brilliant, original people that ever lived. And this contradiction was part of his whole life. He had few friends. His wife stayed with him to the end. But toward the end of his life, people began to think that these great books, America, the Four Zoas, all those things, Jerusalem, the New Albion, that these were actually great, great epic poems. But for many people, they were just incomprehensible scribbling. And in the realm of art, because Blake considered himself as much an artist as a poet and trained actually very formally as an artist, he thought that people like Reynolds and Turner were complete idiots, and he didn't want to have anything to do with them, and he thought they were ruining English painting, and they didn't have outlines. He liked all his figures. See, they all have these outlines on them, and he thought that that was bringing him back to the pre-Michelangelo, the Raphaelian beauty of art, and the other ones were wrong. He was a cantankerous, cranky person who could never get hired at Yale, I can tell you. just impossible. Yes, question.
Yeah, how do you find doing creative work in an academic environment?
Well, the question was, how do I find working on creative work within an academic environment? That's kind of paraphrased, but that's the question. The prize that I received, which was alluded to before, I should explain, the Charles Ives Living Award doesn't have anything to do with resuscitating Charlie's ghost or something like that. It has to do with the fact that the American Academy of Arts and Letters gave me a grant which allowed me to take a leave of absence from my role as head of the composition program at Yale for 3 years, and paid me to do so, and insisted that I not take any essential work during those 3 years, other than doing this kind of thing of making an appearance of some kind or another. And in the course of this 3 years, it has changed me completely in regard to that. On the other hand, the academic world also fed me. One of my great students has become one of my greatest friends, Michael Tenzer, Professor Tenzer, sitting right there now professor at UBC. These people enrich my life and stimulate me to think about things and bring things to me. So in as much as it's true that being an academic takes a lot of time and it's irritating in many ways, It's also a way to get fed. And my goal when I return in the fall is to find the right balance, because I don't think I had the right balance before. I think I was not completely in harmony with that. And it's a struggle. I don't think I'm going to find the right balance, and then it's going to be it forever. I think I'm going to constantly renegotiate, calibrate that to make it work for me. I mean, I have many ideas, and you know, the traveler hasteth in the evening. Yes.
You made a very interesting, for me, an interesting assumption, which I'm not sure is correct in view of the imagery that you presented. What gives you the idea? You ask the question, why is he in such a hurry? And my question is, does he have any choice?
Indeed. So the question was, the premise I proposed was that that there are reasons why he is in a hurry, that he's in a hurry for this reason or that other reason. The questioner asks, perhaps that's not the right question at all, because the traveler has no choice but to haste it in the evening. I think that's a good point. I have no response to that except to say, you know, in a sense, it raises the whole question of free will, doesn't it? But the inevitability, the question of mortality is inevitable, and we all are pressed to hasten. And it does seem, toward the end of any human life, that the foreshortening is horrendous, that the time that preceded it seems so grand and so expansive, and yet as it narrows to that final moment, it seems to rush upon us with this unbelievable velocity, and we have to hasten, even if we don't. It's a kind of Einsteinian relativity question in a way, too. It depends on where you stand, you know, and maybe where you stand in that relationship of that dawn to dusk cycle of life. That may depend on whether you feel you must hasten or you may not hasten, or you may dally or whatever. Very interesting questions. Other questions? Yes?
Is this the first time that poetry has inspired your composing?
Oh, not at all. The question was, is this the first time that poetry has inspired my composing? I have a new disc that's just come out, which is the Opere della Musica Povera. This is the disc. You can't really see it from there. I'm sure I put it up here, but you won't see it either. And on this disc, actually, you can hear Lisa Moore play The Dream of the Lost Traveler. But you will also find other poetic things. For example, there are two psalms that I set here, Psalm 82 and Psalm 131, I believe it is. I've also set the poetry of two poets from Georgia in the United States, and I've also set the poetry of the recently deceased wonderful Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai, who died recently. People should know that poet, great international poet. Poetry inspires me, and many literary sources have inspired me. One of the things you'll find in this as well, references to Kafka, to Walter Benjamin, Melville, the I Ching, Pinocchio, Collodi's great book, Pinocchio, and Schumann, the composer Schumann, Bird as Prophet. So yes, I'm constantly inspired by that. But that's just one source. I have a lot of tributaries in my house has many mansions. Other questions?
While you're thinking of questions, you say your house has many mansions. I will challenge you. I'm a melody whistler. How about the first concerto for Whistler and Orchestra?
Who wrote the first concerto? You would like to see me do it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. You know, the other day, yesterday, Lisa Moore played a work of Frederick Jevsky, which was based on, actually also about speaking, it was based on Oscar Wilde's book, De Profundis. And in the course of her performance, she had to sing and whistle. So I am not at all opposed to whistling. There used to be a saying that boys can whistle, but girls must sing. Does anybody actually remember that old saying?
Yes.
It's kind of a weird thing. I never quite understood why boys could whistle, but and girls must sing. But that's an old saying. But I think girls can whistle, and I will definitely use it if it seems appropriate.
Where did that originate? Any idea?
I don't know. Does anybody know? Where did they come from?
The idea is that women
naturally. And men have to blow because that was men's business, but they were frauding it because women really created, but the whistling, the blowing of spirit was what men took over, and that is why.
That's why, and that's why Lauren Bacall says to Humphrey Bogart, you know how to whistle, don't you? Just put your lips together and blow.
Mm-hmm.